Thank you so much. Thank you so much for those two talks. We're going to turn it over to the research delegation right now, and I'll let you introduce yourself because I thought it was going to be someone else.
Oh, great.
Hi, my name is Alex Cebulski. I'm a surveillance scholar at the University of Toronto, at the Faculty of Information there, the iSchool, so to speak. So you guys brought up a lot of great questions, and I thank you very much for your presentations. And because your material online, what you talk about, is slightly different from what you've presented today, it kind of goes back and forth. I have two questions, but I think I'll stick to the main one right now, and that regards privacy. And I was wondering if you saw privacy as still a useful discourse to talk about the issues that are going on with surveillance right now, and if privacy isn't more problematic and if it doesn't obfuscate larger political issues with the problems of surveillance. Because privacy does have its origins, the private sphere has its origins in, I think, the 18th century, in an emerging middle class where people believed that they could build up walls around themselves. And, Mark Andreevic couldn't be with us today, but, you know, what he would have pointed out is that there's this problem that we have of dealing with surveillance as being reified, that we're losing privacy, as sort of privacy being something that emerged and that we're slowly sort of going back away from. So I was wondering if you guys still saw privacy as something that's worth discussing, or if privacy is obfuscating, you know, political problems, which, Jillian, you pointed out with freedom of speech and freedom of association that are associated with these sort of broader surveillance issues. Thank you.
So personally, I've spent most of my time thinking about surveillance in the context of free expression, freedom of association. That said, I wouldn't take privacy off the table, and I also think that while what you say is true for certain societies, I don't find that to be universally applicable to people's conceptions of privacy. That hasn't been my experience with talking with people in a lot of other places in the world, and I find that while considerable research makes claims about people's conceptions of privacy in, for example, the Arab world, since that's what I talked about, the individual accounts from people these days are quite different from the Western conceptions of what they think. And so I think for me, the jury's still out, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that privacy is obviously something that many people care about, and there are different views on whether people think that government surveillance goes too far. There are even many people who think that what we've learned this summer is in fact not a big deal. No matter your views on whether the government should be getting this stuff, and even if they're getting it at an appropriate scale, even whether getting everyone's information is okay if they just promise to use it in the right way, I think the bigger picture story here, and one that I think anyone and everyone should embrace, is that the oversight process in our respective countries is broken. It's my understanding that you have even less oversight over your intelligence services than we do in the United States, which is, I think, alarming given how bad things are in the U.S., but the NSA and their associated friends in the intelligence community basically have free rein to do what they want. There are two committees in the Congress that have largely been captured. No one on those committees really understands the technology of modern surveillance, and the FISA court itself really doesn't have any idea what's taking place. They have been misled by the government. Not intentionally, but because they didn't really understand what the government was doing and didn't know how to ask the right questions, particularly given the insanely complex technology that is involved in modern surveillance. When you have intelligence services that are essentially collecting every bit that comes in and out of a country, it's really difficult for a lawyer who has spent, you know, all of their life working on the law and not a computer scientist to really understand what's going on. And when Congress and the courts are reliant on the NSA or the CIA or other parts of the intelligence community to volunteer information about what they're doing, of course the oversight process is broken. And so really I think this actually reflects a bigger problem that we have in our society, which is that many parts of the government simply cannot be kept in check when the things they're doing involve so much technology and there are so few technical skills in the legislative bodies and in the courts.
So we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. I just want to submit a case study to you that is happening right now in Montreal as we speak. If you take the public transport at the moment, you'll see all the staff is wearing these T-shirts saying surveillance camera for our security. So basically what the unions of the public transport in Montreal, what they're trying to do is have a network of surveillance cameras throughout the transport system, including the buses. So I just want to submit that, what is your reaction to that?
So one of the things we've learned this summer, so surveillance cameras on public transport are actually not a very new thing, but the new part that I've learned is that the companies that manufacture buses have started, in many cases, to pre-install microphones into the buses. And since the wire is there and the microphones are installed, and in the grand scheme of the cost of a bus, a microphone is a very, very cheap thing. And so it just makes sense to just do it by default in all buses. And so what's started to happen is that cities have realized that they have these microphones in their buses and are starting to record what takes place in the buses. I think this is really problematic. There's a very well-regarded Fourth Amendment scholar. So the Fourth Amendment is our part of the Constitution that protects privacy, named Bill Stuntz. He's now deceased. And he has this great article that he writes, one of my favorite law review articles, on inequality and privacy. And basically what he says is that the poor get screwed on privacy. Right? So the rich don't have cameras in their cars, but the poor have cameras and microphones in buses. The police can bring drug dogs onto the buses whenever they'd like, but they don't do that in your vehicle. The rich have air conditioning in their homes, and the poor don't. So in the summers, the poor sit on the steps of their homes and have conversations in public and drink beer, in public. He goes through many of these examples, but I think what you're capturing there, even though it may be for good intentions, because it is intended to make sure that people are not assaulting the staff on the bus, it does demonstrate the fact that the poor really do get screwed when it comes to privacy. And I think we all should be thinking about that and doing everything we can to make sure that that they have their privacy protected too.
I absolutely agree. And I think that this is also coming back to the freedom of association argument. When you think about, I'll use an example that's not technological because I find that actually easier to wrap my head around sometimes, the New York Police Department's infiltration of mosques. That's an excellent example of where freedom of association is really primary rather than privacy. The issue is not the ability to, it is to some degree, of course, but the main issue for me is not the ability to maintain your privacy within that sacred space. The issue is the conversations that happen are being infiltrated, are creating a culture of fear that prevents people from having the kind of whatever dialogue they want to have. And that's the same thing with the buses. My concern is not the government knowing what kinds of things I search on Google, although I do believe fundamentally that needs to be protected and that my privacy there needs to be protected. But my concern is the government mapping my network. And that comes, it's the same issue there with microphones. With cameras, I understand, of course, we can argue of whether they're appropriate. But with cameras on buses, without sound, you're looking at, you can identify someone with a weapon. You can identify someone doing something illegal like that. But when you have audio on that as well, you're talking about a much stronger capture of the kinds of, incidental capture of conversations. And that's what really kind of concerns me.
Although you get this really interesting issue where if you allow just the recording but not the audio, then you're violating the privacy of people who use sign language more than people who speak with their voices.
Good point.
Okay, I had a question for Chris, Trevor Schultz from the New School. I really enjoyed your talk. I just wondered where you ended up with it, but I can completely follow your logic of, in the end, commoditizing privacy. I wonder if you don't really trade in privacy as a right for privacy as a commodity, which I'm not sure I would want to sign on to that move that you are making there in the end.
I mean, if you look at what's happened this summer, so right, there have been a bunch of disclosures about spying. And many of the technology companies have had their reputations harmed, and some of the technology companies, more than others, have been racing to deploy technology that will thwart certain kinds of surveillance. And Google is probably the leader here in terms of being an early adopter of cutting-edge security technologies, and Yahoo is probably like the worst of the bunch in dragging their feet as slowly as they can. But even Google has just taken care of the ways that the government can surveil you without Google's help. So what Google has done is make sure that the connection between your computer and Google's servers is as secure as possible, and then the connection between Google's servers and Google's other servers are as secure as possible. They don't want the government going through the back door, but they haven't done anything to stop the government from going through the front door. And there always is a front door as long as these companies collect data about us. And you know, I give Google credit because it's my impression that the security team at Google at this point has a blank check to do whatever they want. Whatever, no matter how much it costs, they can deploy the best technology there is to encrypt and protect their customers' data. But the employees of Google have a legitimate reason and need to see their customers' data because of the business model that's being used. I think that I'm not opposed to online advertising, and I'm not opposed to advertising-supported services. I just really dislike the negative side effect associated with those services, and I don't think many people realized. I think the focus for many years in the privacy community and in civil society was on the advertising. Like, the harm was, oh my goodness, Google's tracking me, and they know what I'm interested in. But that was the tip of the iceberg, and the bit of the iceberg that was under the water that would actually destroy the boat was the creation of these large databases that governments could then get. And really, it's the business model. The business model is toxic.
So I'm very sympathetic to Chris. I was very sympathetic to what you were saying about the business model of Google and Twitter being completely unsustainable. On the other hand, I have a very difficult time seeing either Google becoming a much more secure service because that's not sustainable, and seeing Google ultimately going away. I don't see Dark Mail Alliance or RiseUp replacing that, and I don't see those kind of more encrypted surveillance-free services replacing these commercial and a lot more attractive models. So how do you see that happening? I mean, like, LavaBit was more of a niche market, for security-conscious people.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think Jillian may have some thoughts once we sort of bring this into the international context. You know, after these stories broke, and particularly after the stories about the U.S. spying on foreign governments have come to light, the instant reaction from, say, the Germans or the Brazilians have been, okay, we need to keep our data within Germany, or we need to keep our data within Brazil. But you have to remember that surveillance through the network, or even surveillance by compelling a company like Google to hand over data, is just one of the tools that the NSA has at its disposal. It's not the only tool they have. There is a team, a fairly large team, of people at the NSA who only hack into computers. The NSA hacked into a Brazilian oil company. Their partners at GCHQ, using U.S. technology, hacked into the systems of Belgacom, one of Belgium's largest telephone companies. If the Brazilians keep their data inside Brazil, all that's going to do is force the NSA to hack into more Brazilian systems. If the Germans keep data in Germany, all that's going to do is force the NSA to hack into German systems. The only way you actually keep the Americans out is to encrypt the data. The only way you keep the Chinese or the Israelis or the Russians out is to encrypt the data in a way that only the customers who create the data can access it. But the problem with this approach is that then domestic law enforcement agencies cannot get data either. Right? The technology that will keep a foreign government hacking team out will also keep your own local police out. And surely you should imagine that the Chinese government has far greater technical resources than your own local police. And there isn't much in the way of domestic appetite in many countries for a shift to a world where the police cannot read the emails of the bad guys. There isn't any appetite for a world in which the police cannot get the Google searches of the bad guys. But really, this is what is going to have to happen. And so if we do see a shift to fully encrypted technologies, it's not going to be because the market takes us there. It's going to be because governments demand it, because they're worried about the threat of foreign governments reading their communications.
Yeah, there's really not much that I can add to that, although, I mean, I would say, you know, the other concern, of course, with what Brazil's doing is the idea that this will then create a sort of windfall and have other countries taking the same approach. And while I absolutely understand my Brazilian friend's desire to see this happen, I'm less sympathetic when, say, Saudi Arabia takes the same approach. And I say that because we know what they do in terms of censorship. We know already what they do in terms of surveillance. And so keeping this is a problem, right? Because for a lot of people in a lot of places in the world, the U.S. currently is the best place to keep your data for a number of reasons, for the intermediary liability protections that we have, for the fact that that a lot of these companies won't hand over data to certain governments, although that's changing. I don't know if you noticed, but Facebook now hands data over to the Pakistani government. They don't need to. They don't have a mutual legal assistance treaty. They don't have anybody on the ground in that country, and yet they do anyway. And so, you know, that's part of the issue there. And then the other one is, of course, we don't know which countries the NSA is sharing data with. There have been some rumblings now that the NSA might be sharing data with Jordan. And so at that point, what is your choice if you live in that country? Your choice is, okay, you can host your data on a U.S. site. You can host your data on a European site, for example, but that may not be better. It depends on the country and the service. Or you can try to host your data on a local site. But as Chris said, really, then the issue is that without the strong encryption, your local government has that access as well. And so while that may or may not concern us very much in Brazil, I think it should, but I can see where Brazilians would want that. That should very much concern us in a lot of places in the world.
Hi, Lisa Lynch, Concordia. Someone else can speak to this probably better, but I just wanted to say, apropos of that, that in Quebec, where universities were often told not to let our students, or to mandate that our students put information on U.S. servers. In other words, we're not supposed to use certain Google or certain social media applications that will drive them onto U.S. servers, and there's specific Quebec regulations around that. But my question is about, I wanted to try to connect the talk that we had on smart cities with this conversation, because I think the kind of discussion of the political economy of surveillance is resonant with that, too. And I wanted to see if you could make a bridge between this sort of smart city surveillance model where a city is kind of approached by a corporation like Genentech and kind of sold on the idea of the surveillance city, you know, and that is a certain kind of business model as well, and this discussion of kind of the economy of surveillance that Google and a lot of social media companies have, because I think it, in some ways we've got the same situation. You've got this surveillance business model and all of this data being collected, and then, of course, the data needs to go somewhere.
So technologists generally consider data in two forms, whether it's communications content or metadata, although it's a very blurry line. So the metadata is generally information about the transaction, and then the content is reveals what took place in the transaction. So, you know, who you email is metadata, and what's in the email is content. And in many countries, the various kinds of data get different protections. In the United States, for example, content gets higher protection under the law, and metadata gets very little to no protection under the law. And in the context of smart cities, much of this is about the creation of even more metadata. This is all transaction data: where you go, when you swipe into a building, when you get on the bus, when you buy new milk and then your smart fridge recognizes it. And the thing is that the technology that lets you, the technologies that we have right now that let you keep yourself secure and safe are largely geared towards protecting the content. There are technologies that let you hide your metadata, the who you communicate with, but there are really high costs associated with those. So, for example, the most widely used and well-studied technology that lets you hide metadata is Tor. It lets you browse the web anonymously, and people won't know whom you're communicating with. But Tor has and suffers from a problem of high latency. There's a delay when you use Tor. And so you can use Tor to have a conversation via instant message. But I've tried many a time, but real-time communications via Tor are exceedingly unpleasant. You cannot do video conferencing over Tor.
Can't even use it at our hotel.
Yeah. And so what that means is that it may not be possible to protect certain kinds of metadata, or at least the cost of protecting it may be so high, the unpleasantness may be so high that people refuse to go down that path. In the context of smart cities, you know, so in my city in Washington, D.C., we have these smart cards that you can use to get on the subway, and I used to pay for every subway trip with cash and get a paper ticket, and then my city instituted a tax. If you want to use a paper ticket, they charge you $1 more per fare. I've had to perform some kind of calculation in my own head of how much do I value my privacy, and it turns out I don't value it at $1 per trip. And so I've signed up for this smart card. But I think in many cases, the cost of keeping your metadata out of the government's hands, or the cost of not creating that metadata trail, is going to be too high, because it's going to require that people really disengage from many of the useful services that we have in our cities.
Absolutely. I mean, the example that I thought of that was the I remember what it's called in California, but the fast pass, the mechanism that you can use to go through a toll booth quickly, that just kind of pings the toll booth. It turns out that in California, you can actually pay for that with cash. But you have to go to some obscure office in the basement of a building in the middle of a weird neighborhood, and then pay for it with cash, and then you have to refill it only like $20 at a time. So it's it's incredibly incredible high barrier to entry on that. At the same time, I actually would argue that a lot of these things are worth fighting for in that sense, and I think the best example would be opting out of the TSA, Thank you. And airports. Sorry.
So you mean the massage versus the body scanner?
Yes, the massage. Yeah. I'm glad you're aware of the massage, yes. And so that was, somebody had made an argument to me about that, where I hadn't been opting out because I really don't like the grope. But it's true that if we stop doing that, that disappears for everyone. And so I do it now solely on principle, even though I actually can't stand it. I would much rather personally go through the scanner.
I actually like the massage.
You're not the first person who said that.
Yeah. Oh, hi. Thank you both for coming today. I had a question for Jillian, actually. I thought your talk was really interesting, especially juxtaposed with what we heard from Christina earlier about how activism can sometimes reproduce systems of inequality. And I'm just wondering how, I'm not sure how large the network is of Western active internet media activists in the Middle East is, but through your research and writing, have you seen these systems of inequality being reproduced through your activism? And isn't it a bit ironic that Western activists are going to combat the surveillance technology that our country is exporting to those countries in the first place?
So I would first say that a lot of the activism around this in the region comes from people in the region, and there is definitely an issue around funding, for example. So you do have the U.S. State Department and Google, for that matter, funding a lot of the organizations that are fighting back against it. At the same time, you have systems where in a lot of parts of the world, I'm not going to focus, it's unfair to qualify this for an entire region or even for the world, but in a lot of places you don't have the same types of charity culture that you do in the U.S., and for that matter, the tax breaks that you have in the U.S., and so there's not a whole lot of impetus for people to donate to these types of groups, and so you've seen a lot of struggle around funding, where it's true that there's a really interesting hypocrisy when the State Department puts a few million dollars into internet freedom around the world, while then you've got the DOD and the NSA, on the other hand, putting billions of dollars into repression in the U.S. and around the world. And it's really kind of a losing battle in that sense. It's actually sort of hard to even understand why they're doing it at this point when they know that they can't win. So that system, I would absolutely, to come back to your question around systems of inequality, one of the issues there is that you've got a lot of groups in a number of countries, and the two examples I can think of are Egypt and Pakistan, where I've talked to organizations that absolutely fundamentally refuse to take U.S. government money, but that means that they're then pushed down by the organizations that are absolutely willing to take it, and that creates a really interesting sort of sense of inequality around that. And a lot of times the groups that are taking the U.S. government money are sort of astroturfing and not doing anything particularly effective. And so my hope is that the other groups are going to kind of win out on that battle, but it does oftentimes feel like a very downhill battle.
So I didn't get a chance to respond to Jillian's excellent talk. So I just wanted to make one quick point. These devices, the blue coat censorship and surveillance devices that are placed on networks in foreign countries and in the United States, if you want to spy on a country and you're not that government, that's the device you attack. Those devices are at a unique place in the network and have a unique amount of access to all the data going in and out of a country. And although the State Department has certainly investigated the exportation of this technology, I think that, and I should be clear, I'm more paranoid than the average person, but I suspect that the folks at NSA are much happier that it's a U.S.-made device that's controlling at this central point of control on a Syrian network than they are that it would be, say, a Chinese device. If the NSA needs information about how the device works, they can go to Blue Coat and ask for, you know, a product sheet, and they can ask for source code, and they can ask for this other information. And I suspect that there are many people in the intelligence community who are quite happy that there is U.S.-made technology that's sitting in the core infrastructure of these foreign networks, in the same way that U.S. politicians were freaking out at the possibility that Huawei equipment might be used in U.S. telecommunications networks, in the way that the Australian government has freaked out over the same issue. It turns out that being able to influence and have access to large tech companies is really, really useful when you want to spy on foreign governments.
What's interesting, though, is you've also seen a lot of Western activists. I mean, I think probably most prominently people like Marie Cechek in the European Parliament arguing that, you know, Western companies should not, on moral grounds, be involved in this. And, I mean, that is a perfectly fine argument to make. But then you've also got people saying, yes, but what happens when the Western companies all pull out and then the Chinese companies are perfectly willing to step in? I mean, there's not really a good solution there because we're not going to stop the rest of the companies from doing it either, which is not to say that I prefer Blue Coat, mind you, over Huawei. I would prefer neither.
So we have time for one more quick question and quick answer.
This is a horrible quick question because it's going to require a very, I think it's going to provoke an aggressive conversation. But I have a problem with this discourse of privacy that you've proposed. As the gentleman pointed out, it points towards the commodification of privacy. Two, I think it promotes more technology and more policy hacks to create solutions to surveillance. I saw Chris, I saw the president of the ACLU present with Bill Binney last month. And Bill Binney seemed to think that the better solution here would be to have less surveillance. And isn't that, in fact, the best discourse to refute big surveillance, big data, is to actually strip back surveillance? And sort of that's the question I'm getting at here. Is throwing more money, more technology, more policy at this problem really the best answer? Or is demanding a retraction of the surveillance state something more meaningful?
So whatever my boss's boss said, I'm sure was correct. definitely wouldn't want to get fired. No, I'm just kidding. I work for a free speech group. I can say basically what I want. So even if you think that you can extract a promise and commitment from the United States government that they will stop spying, and even if you think that you can extract a promise from your own government and put in a system of oversight and regulation such that your intelligence service will be kept under control, you have no power over the Chinese government. You have no power over the Israeli government, the Spanish government, the French government, and they all have embassies, in Toronto where they're doing spying. At some point, you may stop using Google services and you may start using a Chinese company for your email or a Russian company for your email. With those other governments, you have no way of knowing what they're doing. Even if you trust my government, you definitely shouldn't trust the Chinese or the Russians or the Israelis because you know that they're in the surveillance business too. And so really, we do need technology. The only way you can protect your communications at the end of the day is through technology. Particularly when everything that these governments are doing always happens behind closed doors. You have no way of verifying if they're actually keeping to their promises.
So I'll add a short answer on top of that. I would say I agree with you in theory, but I agree with Chris in reality, which is to say that I don't even believe that it's possible to roll back the infrastructure in the U.S. at this point. I don't trust my government. I don't believe that it will happen. And it's true, I'm also more paranoid than your average person, I'm sure. But the other thing on top of that is just that, you know, I do think that we need to come up with a multi-pronged approach. And part of that is policy. Part of it is law. Part of it is, I mean, law and litigation. Part of it is technology. And then I also think part of it really is a shift in culture. And that is, in some cases, around transparency and lack of privacy, unfortunately. Not everyone will agree with me, but I've done a lot of talking with activists over the past couple of years and their practices and their beliefs. And two things have struck me, and I'll stop after this. One is people saying, I don't believe in organizing online anymore. I do believe in privacy, but I don't think that electronically organizing is the solution at this point. And so I'm going to take my organizing and I'm going to do it offline. And I think that's a very valid solution. It's a conversation that we should have. The other one is just around whether or not transparency, and this often comes up more in arguments around anonymity, but whether or not transparency and just using, you know, putting oneself out there and using one's real name and taking claim for that is actually an option. For a lot of people, that's not an option. I realize that I'm saying that from an absolute position of privilege, but I'm also watching more and more people take that position. And so I do think that in terms of a cultural shift, we may see more in both in that direction, both of those directions.